Rugby is a sport that often makes headlines for reasons beyond the pitch, and on Monday morning it was no different. Former England flanker Lewis Moody has become the latest in a long line of rugby players to receive a heartbreaking diagnosis. It's News Talk Daily, I'm Ciara Doherty.
Shane Byrne again, accurate, to the tail. Used to be a lot, O'Connell too. And they're swapping and they're switching and they're a threat constantly to New Zealand at the line out. Now a Noah's try!
A couple of months ago, noticed I was getting shoulder weakness and went and saw our physio. Kerry did a fantastic job, gave me some rehab stuff to crack on with, and nothing really changed over the course of sort of 6 to 8 weeks, at which point he referred me to a brilliant shoulder specialist. I had an MRI, neck scan, all that type of stuff. And very quickly, when the scans came back, it became clear that it wasn't anything to do with the neck, despite all the years of sort of throwing myself into contact on the rugby pitch. And he then sent me straight to the neurologist and off the back of the MRI, he actually had a phone call with me where I sensed he was preparing me for the worst, which was fairly difficult information at the time to receive, I suppose. But we processed lots of emotions over the last couple of weeks. And I suppose when you talk about it, and I generally feel fine when you talk about it, it's never me that I feel sad for. It's the sort of sadness around having to tell my mum, you know, as an only child, and the implications that has for her, having to tell the boys. I mean, you know, two brilliant boys, and that was pretty heartbreaking, wasn't it?
Lewis Moody there, a former England captain and part of that iconic 2003 World Cup winning team against Australia, announced on social media that he's living with motor neuron disease, having only received the diagnosis 2 weeks ago. And MND is a terminal illness, and a number of rugby players, I'm thinking of Rob Burrows and Doddy Weir, have been diagnosed with it in recent years and have passed away. But do we really understand the link, if any, between rugby and motor neuron disease? And if we don't, what will it take to get to a world that is free from this illness? Well, later we're going to be hearing from Kevin Byrne, who's from the IMNDA, about the work that they do to support people living with motor neuron disease. But first, to find out what MND really is and if there is a link between this sport and this disease, I'm joined by Professor Orla Hardiman, who is the lead of the MND clinic at Beaumont Hospital. Professor Hardiman, you're very welcome to News Talk Daily. I'm sure you, me, anybody who watched that interview with Lewis Moody, who heard him speak about his diagnosis, his very, very recent diagnosis, can see just how devastating it is for somebody to be told that they have MND.
Oh, absolutely. It is. It's a catastrophic diagnosis. When we talk to people who have symptoms and whom we have confirmed a diagnosis, it's one of the hardest things that I do in my career is explain to people that they have a condition for which we don't yet have a cure, and which will definitely shorten their life expectancy. It's a very, very difficult time for the person. It's very difficult diagnosis to disclose. On the other hand, we can help. There is hope that we can give, and we can talk about the treatments that we're developing and how we walk the walk with people. But it doesn't take away from the catastrophic nature of the news that is imparted, especially in a young man like him. He's only 47. I mean, it's absolutely devastating.
So what is the disease, Professor? What's actually happening inside your body?
So motor neuron disease is part of a family of conditions called the neurodegenerations. So in these conditions, groups of nerves that are really important in our functioning stop working. They become sick and they die. And in motor neuron disease, mostly it's the nerves that control movement, the motor nerves. And there are two major types of motor nerves, the ones that go from the brain down into the spine and the ones then that go from the spine into the muscle. And both sets of nerves are affected. It's unusual in a neurodegeneration that the ones outside the nervous system are affected as well. So what it leads to is difficulty with voluntary movement. So difficulty moving legs, difficulty moving arms, limping, becoming losing dexterity. And it affects the speech and the swallowing muscles as well, because they're volitional as well. So people will develop a little bit of a slur in their voice or might run into difficulty with their swallowing, initiating swallowing. And then, unfortunately, most people with motor neurone disease also develop a little bit of trouble with their breathing. So we have to help by giving people support with their breathing as well. A proportion of people with motor neurone disease also have involvement of other nerves as well, in addition to the motor nerves. So we see people who, for example, lose their ability to read other people. It's called social cognition. That's not uncommon. Some people become a little bit cognitively impaired, a little bit slowed down in processing. And some people, their personalities will change a little bit as well. So it is probably relevant that Lewis Moody's uncle and his father, I think it was, had a dementia, because motor neurone disease sometimes runs with dementia in other members of the family as well.
I think in Ireland, we all have this very clear visual of what MND is, and that degeneration of the body, that deterioration, because of Charlie Bird, who was so particularly vocal about the condition, the disease and its progress.
Yes, I have to say, though, that I knew Charlie very well. And he was very brave and very courageous in the way he articulated the distress that he was experiencing. But, you know, I see nearly everybody in the country with motor neurone disease. And most people are able to, I think, accommodate to some extent to the loss and to their disability. And we've done a lot of work looking at this as well in people with motor neurone disease and their family members. And people can have, you know, quite a good quality of life, notwithstanding the evolving disability. So I think Charlie was a little bit unusual in that his accommodation to his illness, he had great difficulty accommodating to it. And, you know, it was just, he was brave and courageous for articulating that.
Sean, every day I'm facing a challenge. My voice has gone, and that is why I am talking to you with my voice bank app. My swallow is the major issue for me now, and every meal I sit down to is a challenge for me. To be honest, I am now living each day at a time. My goal now is hopefully to get to next Christmas, and after that next May, when I would hopefully still be around to see Bruce Springsteen in concert in Dublin. Sean, every day I am facing a challenge.
But I think some people do experience some peace, and can still experience joy in their lives, even with the progression of the illness.
What are the initial symptoms of it, and what are the various types of MND?
It probably is more than one condition. In fact, we're pretty sure it is. So there's a familial form in Ireland. About 10% of people with the familial form have the familial form, and that is a gene called C9ORF72. That's the name of the gene. And that tends to run in families. So we separate motor neurone disease into those who have a familial form, which runs in families, and most of those have this gene, and people who have a non-familial form where we can't identify anybody else in the wider family who's ever had motor neurone disease or a dementia.
So the familial is inherited, an inherited genetic cause.
A genetic variant, yeah.
And then
the
sporadic MND, you're not quite sure what genetic.
Well, there probably are genes involved. About 50% of the risk is probably genetic, but it's probably lots of small genes, lots of genes with small effect rather than a single gene with a big effect. So there's a lot of work that we're doing trying to identify those smaller genes and trying to understand what's going on there. But from the point of view of people who develop the disease, we say, well, there's a familial form. And then there's, you know, we worry about risk there. And then there's a non-familial form, a so-called sporadic form, where there's nobody in the family who's had anything like this, and it just came directly out of the blue. So we divide it into familial versus non-familial. And then we also divide it into where it starts. So it's traditionally, we divide it into whether it starts in the arms or the legs. And that could start with a limp or a little bit of hand movement loss, a little bit of loss of dexterity. Or if it starts in the speech and the swallow, which is where it starts with Charlie, where the speech becomes a little bit slurred and swallowing becomes a little bit more difficult. So the latter form is called the bulbar onset, because that's the part of the brain that's affected. And the other part then, where it starts in the arms and the legs, is called spinal onset. So we divide the disease into spinal onset versus bulbar onset. But really, our ways of understanding the different subtypes of motor neurons are not very sophisticated. And we're pretty sure from the research that we do that there are lots of different subtypes that probably have different causes and different trajectories. And we can understand that a bit better, we'd be able to find better treatments.
Okay, so we're kind of clear, I suppose, on the very specific, the familial MND, where there is this clear genetic factors, and you're saying there is some genetic role in this sporadic MND. But are there other Correct. Factors, like environmental and lifestyle factors, yeah. that you believe contribute to or increase the risk of developing this yeah. disease?
So these are very difficult questions, because this is a relatively rare disease. And trying to understand environmental factors in a rare disease is very difficult. You come up with a lot of false positives. But there is a signal which we are trying to understand among elite athletes, some types of elite athletes, some type of elite athleticism, where there seems to be a higher rate of motor neuron disease in people who are really elite athletes than we would expect. And this was first detected in soccer players in Italy, but it's also there in football players as well, in rugby players, as we know, and in American football players as well. And why that is not very well understood at the moment. It may well be, and I think the prevailing view among myself and my colleagues, is that what makes you really, really good at exercise, really good at sports, may also be a factor that increases your risk of developing motor neuron disease. There's a lot of work going on in this, and some of my colleagues in Sheffield are doing a lot of work on this, about the upregulation of certain genes in people who are very good at athletes and who also have a family risk of motor neuron disease, that might slightly increase their risk. But it's still very much a work in progress in as to how we unpick the relationship between extreme physical exercise with contact and the risk of developing motor neuron disease.
So what you're saying is, at the minute, this is something that researchers are looking into, researchers are investigating, but there is yes. potentially a link between very high Correct. Levels of exercise that has impact?
Yes, it looks like it's impactful exercise.
And would that be head impacts?
Trauma.
Okay.
Trauma, probably. But it's still very much a work in progress, and we haven't dissected that out. There was a study, for example, of cyclists, Italian cyclists, which doesn't show a signal. So you would think, oh, well, they're very elite athletes, and they do, you know, they're very, they engage in very intensive exercise, but they don't have a higher risk of developing motor neuron disease. But there's a discrepancy between cross-country and downhill skiers, where one group is more likely to have a slightly higher risk as well. So it might be to do with the type of exercise, and then whether there's impact involved in the exercise or not.
There was a recent study back in October, I think 2022, that came from the University of Glasgow, which seemed to suggest that the incidence of MND was 15 times higher among former Scotland internationals yeah. than a comparable yeah. demographic yeah. of non-rugby players.
Yeah. Okay, so that was an interesting study. It was based on the concept of traumatic encephalopathy, traumatic brain injury, and the encephalopathy, or the brain damage that we sometimes see with recurrent concussions. And this is a very live topic now, as you know, among impact sports in the NFL in the US, and rugby players here as well. The assumption, or the very small study on brains that were stored in the Glasgow Brain Repository, and that association with motor neuron disease and generating a fold increase, I think was probably not very scientifically valid. I think there was a lot of biases in that study. I mean, I think there is a link there. I think it's evolving. I think clearly banging your head and getting a concussion repeatedly is not good for you. So I think it is a very live area, live subject. It's not as big an issue in motor neuron disease. I think the chronic encephalopathy, traumatic encephalopathy, is part of a landscape. But, you know, I think we, in motor neurons, there are other issues that we are interested in as well as the trauma issue.
Talk to me about the treatments for this disease, Professor. I know you said at the top there isn't a cure, but you say there have been developments in that area.
Yeah, so one of the things that we understand now that we didn't understand before is the fact that this is almost certainly more than one condition, and the mechanism or the way that the disease is happening, developing, it may differ among different subgroups of people. And if we want to develop new drugs, we're going to need to understand those mechanisms by which the disease is evolving. There's one form, the first genetic form that was identified, was a gene called SOD1. And that was identified back in the early 90s. I actually worked in the lab where it was identified, although I wasn't involved in the study. But out of that, there's a gene therapy that has been developed. It's called tofersen, which is effective, which works in that form of motor neuron disease. It's pretty rare. It's familial. And actually, in Ireland, we've not found anybody with familial motor neuron disease attributed to that gene that's natively Irish. We've had a couple of people from other parts of the world, but it's a very rare a gene to be mutated in Ireland. We just don't see it in Ireland. But there are people across Europe who have motor neuron disease caused by mutations in SOD1 who have had their disease slowed down or stopped by receiving this treatment. So that's really encouraging from our point of view. Then there's another very rare mutation called FUS, and we have a family with a FUS mutation. And in fact, one of them is quite a well-known man called Michael Patrick, who's doing a play next week in the Access Theatre in Ballymun, talking about his motor neuron disease.
It's started in my legs and it's still present in my legs. It started, I had a limp, and then I'm in a wheelchair now. But it has gotten quite bad. Like, I can't brace my legs, or I can't move them at all now. And it is slowly getting into my lungs, I think. It's hard to know, but I am finding it more difficult to breathe now.
So Michael, Patrick and his sister are participating in a clinical trial that we're doing to see if the treatment, this gene therapy, will work to slow down their disease. So there is some hope there for the genetic forms. For the non-genetic forms, we have some trials underway at the moment, and we'll have future trials in the next few months looking at these new treatments to see if they're effective. But we're also doing a much larger study across Europe. It's called Precision ALS. ALS is another name for motor neuron disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. We're working with 18 centres across Europe trying to understand the different subtypes of the disease so that in the longer term, we'll be able to subdivide people into the different categories that are characterised by the different pathways that are involved in the disease.
Okay.
And that way we can develop a precision medicine approach towards new treatments.
A more tailored
treatment
for people.
So well on the way in doing that. It's very important to note that even if we can't cure this condition, like I said at the top of the programme there, it doesn't mean that we can't help, and it doesn't mean that people can't have a very good, happy and satisfying life, even if they have motor neuron disease. And in our clinic in Beaumont, we work really hard to try and walk the walk with people, put in the interventions that are needed to allow people to remain independent and autonomous, to support them in the disability that they have, and to support the family members in the loss that they're experiencing, but to make life as normal as possible and as happy and fulfilling as possible.
Professor Orla Hardiman, thank you so much for joining us on News Talk Daily today.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
I'm now joined by Kevin Byrne, who is the CEO of the Irish Motor Neuron Disease Association. Kevin, you're very welcome to News Talk Daily. How many people in Ireland are living with MND?
At the moment, we have around between 450 and 470 registered patients that currently have MND in Ireland on our system. At the moment, there's no really significant treatment and certainly no cure for MND, and that's something that scientists and health professionals across the world are making sure to really work on to try and make sure that that's not the case. Here at IMND, our motto is that we will provide care until there's a cure, so that's what we're doing.
And Professor Hardiman spoke a lot about learning to accommodate the loss, learning to accommodate this catastrophic diagnosis into your life. But also she was really positive about the quality of life that somebody can have even after this diagnosis. So tell me about that.
Well, absolutely. And we hear that from people that we're working with all the time. You know, is that original diagnosis can be very, very difficult to come to terms with, because, you know, you're not, it's not like facing some other things where there's the possibility that you're going to get better. You know, you are effectively being told that you're on this journey and the eventual end of that journey. But we see real positivity from people who have then come to terms with it, and our nurses would work very, very closely with people that have been diagnosed with MND to make sure they can see that there is that quality of life, and that they can spend the time that they have, making sure they spend it with loved ones, doing the things that they want to do, you know, and even as the disease progresses, making sure that they have the right equipment and the right resources in order to have the very, very best standard of living that they possibly can have. So that's really, really important. We are just currently entering into our Walk All You Can fundraiser, which we have on a yearly basis, which is funded by Father Tony Coote. And one of our spokespeople for this year, Paul, would have said that when he was first diagnosed, it took up 90% of his brain capacity to think about MND and that. And he would say now that's more like 10%, and the rest of the time he spends making sure he has the best possible life that he can have.
On that positive note, we will leave it. Kevin Byrne, thank you for your time.
No problem at all. Thank you so much.
Well, that's it from News Talk Daily for today. We'll be back in your feed tomorrow, wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.